from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, an Iran nuclear deal victory for the president. Bernie Sanders surges in Iowa. The Kentucky clerk released from jail, and the refugees keep coming. Over furious dissent, the president toughs out a win in Congress on the Iran deal. He calls it historic.
Our ability to solve a massive national security problem and prevent Iran from getting nuclear weapons without resort to war is a historic achievement.
In Europe, the numbers on foot and boat and rail keep climbing. European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker called on EU members to step up, take them in.
We are not talking about 40,000. We are not talking about 120,000. It's 160,000.
And after sliding in the polls, Hillary Clinton offers an apology for her email use during her time as Secretary of State.
That was a mistake. I'm sorry about that. I take responsibility. And I'm trying to be as transparent as I possibly can.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Paul Singer of USA Today, Rachel Oswald of Roll Call, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Did the Democrats get it right on the Iran nuclear deal? Is the U.S. doing enough to help with the European refugee crisis? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With me from Washington is Paul Singer, Washington correspondent for USA Today. Paul, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing? Thanks for having me.
Great. Thanks for being here. And from Washington, Rachel Oswald joins us, foreign policy and defense reporter for Roll Call. Rachel, great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Paul, and Rachel.
Lots of sound and fury, and ultimately, looks like victory for the president on the Iran deal this week on the Mall before the events of the end of the week. A bunch of Republicans, Donald Trump, Ted Cruz saying, Donald Trump saying, worst negotiation ever, and Ted Cruz saying, disaster.
This Iranian nuclear deal is catastrophic. It is the single greatest national security threat facing America.
But before the week was over, the Republicans could not get past the Democrats. Here was Harry Reid saying, the Senate has spoken.
The Senate has spoken, and they've spoken with a clarion voice and declared that the historic agreement to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon will stand.
Paul Singer, a clarion voice? I mean, after all, this has kind of gone through in the most higgity-piggity way, and not a majority, though the president seems to have won.
This is the magic of the procedure of the United States Senate. The die was cast pretty much when the president agreed in May that the Senate would have, or Congress would have, an opportunity to review this deal. What that means is that the Senate and the House could pass a resolution that would reject the deal. But of course, the president would have to sign that resolution, which, of course, he was not going to do. So the question is simply, were there going to be enough opponents to this deal that they'd be able to override a presidential veto? The answer was probably no from the get-go. And what has happened this week is pretty much what we would have anticipated, is that ultimately the Senate could not even get the bill to the floor because the Democrats held rank and said, no, we are not going to vote on a bill to shut down this deal that the president has negotiated.
They were prepared to filibuster. That's as far as it got. Of course, the Senate and the House have parted ways now. We had John Boehner, House Speaker, yesterday saying Republicans will continue to fight the Iran nuclear deal. Here's Boehner.
Republicans continue to do all that we can do to stop the president's nuclear agreement with Iran. But this debate is far from over. And frankly, it's just beginning. And we'll use every tool at our disposal to stop, slow, and delay this agreement from being fully implemented.
Rachel Oswald, what exactly is the House Speaker talking about there? Is there anything that the House can actually do now, even with more time, to stop this agreement from going into effect writ large? And then what about sanctions in particular? That's the whole deal, is the lifting of sanctions for inspection and restraint on the nuclear front. What's the House got up its sleeve, if anything?
Well, they've got a couple of gambits, but I think they're all pretty, unlikely to succeed. On the one hand, they could try and include anti-Iran deal language in any stopgap funding measure that Congress would pass to keep, you know, the government open after the fiscal year ends at the end of the month. Democrats are already saying, including Democrats like the top Democrat on the Appropriations Committee, Nita Lowey, who did oppose the Iran deal. She's saying, don't even try that. Democrats will stand together in insisting that a clean continuing funding resolution be passed. And that could lead to some interesting showdowns. We'll see. But ultimately, I think it will fail because there is just too much political pressure to keep the government funded. So, another thing they could try to do is to sue the Obama administration. And there's growing rumblings that is something that's popular, particularly with the conservatives.
A suit in court. This is over the side deals that are here between the Iran and the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA?
Exactly. What the Iran Nuclear Agreement Review Act requires is that the president provide Congress with all materials related to the Iran deal, including, you know, quote, side agreements. The question at the heart of this, then, is whether the separate bilateral arrangements that the IAEA negotiates with Iran, as it does with all IAEA member states, which are, you know, confidential, whether that constitutes a side deal. And the question that any court would have in front of it would be, can the legislature of a sovereign nation pass a law granting itself access to the confidential bilateral document that another sovereign nation negotiates with an international institution? That's a pretty, pretty big thing to say. So I think that's why most people are saying it's a long-term gambit. But as we've seen with Republican efforts to, you know, kill the healthcare reform law, they will keep trying. I mean, this is something that has a lot of resonance with conservatives. So I think we can continue to see this in the public eye, even though implementation will go forward, sanctions on Iran will be lifted.
Rachel, remind us what tends to be in these side deals with the IAEA. What kind of thing would be in there that is confidential, and yet it must go in some important fashion to the substance of how this deal will be pursued, overseen? Like what? What would be in there?
Well, these tend to be very technical documents, and they're confidential, so I can't speak with any kind of expertise about what would be in them. But we do understand they're very technical arrangements specifying what kinds of access one country will grant the weapons monitors from the IAEA. You know, these are nuclear facilities. Any country, you know, has concerns about keeping certain things private in their nuclear facilities. But these spell out, you know, things like monitoring samples. We know that with Iran, the specific issue relates to long-held suspicions that it conducted nuclear weapons-relevant research, particularly at this site called Parchin, where intelligence, we don't know where from, but we suspect from the United States, suggests that they conducted tests that were related to a detonator for a potential warhead. You know, this is all that's been suspected. But that resolving those questions is what was in the side agreements with the IAEA.
Jack Beatty, what do you see in this long drama? And is it over?
Well, a part of it is over, but the politics lives on. The president called it a victory for diplomacy, for American national security, and for the safety and security of the world. On the other hand, Lindsey Graham on the Senate floor said, please stop saying this deal makes Israel safer. That's cruel. It's a bet on the future. The president has said, this will be on me. I'll be around in 10 and 15 years, and we'll see. Meanwhile, Ted Cruz said, to an absolute certainty, we know that people will die. We know no such thing. The president is counting on change in Iran, change in its domestic politics, change perhaps in its foreign policy, and we don't know where all that will lead. It is clear, though, he's taken us, as he rightly said, off a path that was headed toward an attack on Iran, and that, you know,
and war, as he often put it.
Yes, and you know, Michael Hayden, the former CIA director, an ornament of the Bush administration, said that an attacking Iran would be the quickest way to ensure that Iran would get a bomb. So it would be counterproductive, even in its own terms, to say nothing of the loss of life and treasure.
Rachel, what does it mean that just even this week, as this is all going on, you've got Iran's Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, saying that Tehran won't expand talks with the United States and predicting Israel wouldn't exist in 25 years. What does that mean if we're counting on a warming of some kind here?
Well, I think we have to remember that he's got his own domestic audiences. You know, there are a lot of conservatives in the country, you know, that have formed his base of support that, you know, their raison d'etre is, you know, America is the great Satan, you know. So, but I also think Khamenei is very pragmatic and very much aware of the changing currents in his country, where you actually have a very, very young population that, while not necessarily being oriented toward a liberal democracy, doesn't want to be isolated from the international community and you know, wants more economic development. And they are wholeheartedly, it seems, behind this Iran nuclear deal. And they want to see Iran playing more of a role in the international community. So I think he's saying things to both sides. On the one hand, he says very anti-America, anti-Israel statements. But on the other hand, he is fine with the President Rouhani saying things that are more indicative of a plan to become less belligerent.
This will live on in American politics as well. Hillary Clinton giving a speech on the Iran nuclear deal, giving her bottom line, distrust and verify.
You remember President Reagan's line about the Soviets, trust but verify. My approach will be distrust and verify. We should anticipate that Iran will test the next president. They'll want to see how far they can bend the rules. That won't work if I'm in the White House. I'll hold the line against Iranian noncompliance. That means penalties even for small violations.
Hillary Clinton talking tough as the New Deal appears to have won its footing, won its way forward. We'll look at that more when we come back with Paul Singer, Washington correspondent for USA Today, Rachel Oswald, foreign policy defense reporter for Roll Call. Jack Beattie is here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, an Iran deal victory for the president. Bernie Sanders catches Hillary Clinton in Iowa in the polls, the Kentucky clerk out of jail, defiant, and the refugees, migrants, both keep coming into Europe and maybe well beyond. We're joined by Rachel Oswald, foreign policy defense reporter for Roll Call. Paul Singer is here, Washington correspondent for USA Today, and our own Jack Beattie. We've got the Europe problem still in everybody's lap over there and maybe beyond as well. Here was the head of the EC, the president there, Jean-Claude Juncker, calling on Europe to step up.
And I really hope that this time everyone will be on board. No poems, no rhetorics. Action is what is needed for the time being.
Action is what is needed, and maybe from the United States in a significantly larger way as well. On Wednesday, here was Republican Senator John McCain, Arizona, on the Senate floor talking about what's kind of a global refugee crisis. He stood in front of the picture of the body of Aylan Kurdi, the Syrian toddler everyone seen washed ashore, dead, and he called on the United States to do more to help the refugees.
This image has haunted the world, but what should haunt us even more than the horror unfolding before our eyes, the thought that the United States will continue to do nothing meaningful about it.
Paul Singer, what is the United States ready to do at this point? The latest number I've heard is 10,000. We've got 70,000 total refugees coming to this country per year now, but most of them not from this region, from Somalia and elsewhere. What do you see coming in terms of the U.S. on these numbers?
Right. Well, the president has announced that he would like to go to 10,000 refugees from the Syrian crisis. Raising some of the caps in our current immigration policies. You know, this is a tough issue for the United States. We have a very long tradition of opening our arms to the tired, the huddled masses from other nations. The Statue of Liberty stands in New York as a symbol that we are a beacon of freedom and a beacon of hope.
Lindsey Graham says take them in or take it down, the Statue of Liberty.
That is right, and that is a very strong current through all of American tradition. The other problem, however, and you'll hear a lot of this, and you're already hearing it in the political campaigns, is that we are very concerned about terrorism. We are very concerned about terrorism, particularly from this part of the world. We do not know exactly who these refugees all are. We don't have a particularly reliable way of vetting them. You can't – I mean, we do. We spend a year or two processing everybody to figure out if they're actually terrorists before we let them in. But there are still questions that I think people fairly have about, are we certain that they're coming here – for freedom and not for mischief? And the answer is we may not be certain with all of them, and that is disconcerting.
Rachel Oswald, is Europe getting its act together here? There was this call for binding requirements from each member of the European Union to take X amount out of 120 or 160,000. First of all, that number confuses me. Germany alone was talking about perhaps 800,000 this year. And what about the EU cohesion on this? How's it look?
There's no cohesion from what I can tell. I think this could be, I hesitate to say a make or break issue, but this is a defining issue for the European Union. They've had a lot of really big issues that go to the heart of what the EU is all about in recent years, how to respond, you know, to the Greece financial crisis, how to respond to Russians' annexation of nearby Crimea. And more or less, they came out united on those issues, although particularly, you know, with Greece, there was a lot of internal fighting about that. But I think the disarray in the response to the refugee crisis is a whole nother ball game for them to deal with, and it's running. There's a growing, and this was growing before the Syrian refugee crisis ballooned into what it is today. But you saw far right political parties gaining in countries all over Europe, you know, in the UK, in the Netherlands, and in France, and this is going. This is touching like a serious. I mean, this just goes to the heart of the future of Europe. You have a mostly white population that is not replenishing itself in numbers to maintain itself. There is a ready population coming from the Middle East, coming from Africa, that desperately wants to be part of Europe. And you have questions being raised by European countries about, will this change our culture? Will this change identity if many of these immigrants are Muslim? Will they want to change the character of our democracies? This goes to the very, very heart of what Europe is about in ways the Greece financial crisis just didn't touch.
Rachel, flip it to the source here, to Syria and the surrounding region. I mean, one headline we saw this week was really interesting here. Russian forces with a deepening military role in Syria's civil war. Why now? What's going on there? What's new with that? And how does it relate to this bigger picture of growing international unease about spillover?
Well, there are a couple of theories at play. Russia, Moscow, President Putin will say, well, we have always, and they have said, we have always been supporting President Bashar Assad. We have long existing military arrangements, and they do. But the uptick now suggests that possibly President Putin thinks that the tide is really turning definitively against Bashar Assad, and you could be left with a rump state that Russia wants to be in a position to help defend. I'm not sure how they would defend it, or that they see Bashar Assad's days as ultimately numbered, but they want to make sure that whomever comes to power in his place is oriented toward Russia, is friendly toward Russia.
Jack, what do you see unfolding here in Europe, in the United States, as Americans watch what's happening, and then on the ground, where ultimately this will have to be settled?
Well, Mr. Juncker said Europe is a continent where almost everyone has been a refugee. America is a country where almost everyone has been an immigrant. And both the Washington Post and the New York Times really criticized the Obama administration for what they say is a very inadequate, the 10,000 more people, a very inadequate effort. They point out that the International Rescue Committee has called on the U.S. to take 65,000 Syrians by the end of this year, as against 10,000. And they point out one of the reasons we're going to take so paltry amount by comparison is that we're not relaxing the 18-month to 24-month vetting of applicants. There's going to be no expediting of that. So it's as if within the Obama administration, the security argument has won out over a moment, it seems to me, for the president to have projected American idealism and the American tradition. But apparently the security people in his administration triumphed.
I mean, Paul, we are talking about this on the anniversary of September 11th. When the president, when the administration says it wants to vet applicants, and the president's been pretty tough and open about that, that clearly has some currency. Scott Walker says that's all we need to do is think about security. What about this balance of security versus just a heartbreaking scenes of human suffering?
You know, Tom, our nation is different than it was 20 years ago. Our nation is just fundamentally different than it was 20 years ago. And I don't think we can ignore...
Forever?
I don't know about forever. You know, I don't expect to live that long.
Well, it's 14 years now since 9/11. And, of course, we've had periods where we turned our back on immigrants before, despite the history of immigration that, of course, is the fundamental view here.
Absolutely.
But the Statue of Liberty is still out there. Is Lindsey Graham right? Take it down. Huddled masses yearning to be free. No more?
You cannot deny, and again, I have no opinion in this matter because it's not my job to have opinions, but what I can tell you is that there is a fairly broad political consensus that we need to be concerned about particularly Muslim extremists trying to infiltrate the United States. The security apparatus in the United States is very concerned about it, and the political apparatus in the United States is possibly more concerned about it than the security apparatus is. So you will never be able to, and I don't know about never, but let's just say in our moment in time, you will never be able to simply open your arms broadly and say, let us bring 100,000 Muslim immigrants here from the Middle East and let them move into our communities without a serious pause for a security review. It just is not going to happen, I don't think, in a meaningful way. And you know, get back to the Willie Horton issue of the old Dukakis days. You know, the first person who comes and commits some sort of horrible act sets us back another 35 years.
Let's go to
I would just add to that,
Rachel.
That I think there's a lot of discord with that. On the one hand, there Paul is right. There is, hearing it from the left and the right, they want only to take in refugees if they've been screened. And so while that might delay and reduce any serious U.S. response to meaninglessness, at the same time, count on there continuing to be violent attacks in America perpetuated by mentally unstable individuals who have easy access to guns. So on the one hand, we're saying we don't want terrorism
here. But that's
here.
A whole lot of people who have nothing to do, many, many, many of them, with anything in the Middle East.
Right. So on the one hand, we're saying we don't want, you know, dangerous refugees, but Americans will still be subjected to terrorism, domestic terrorism by mentally unwell people, by people motivated by racism.
We got it. Let me go to Joe in Toronto, Canada. Joe, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. Be honest with you, as a Hungarian, I'm tired of the whole world is bashing us. Everybody's complaining to us. Everybody's telling us what to do. This is not our war. These are not our refugees. Back in the late 80s, early 90s, we opened up our borders for East Germany. Everybody forgets to mention that. I was very disappointed with you on Wednesday when you had a lady guest who mentioned it, that why not Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and all those Middle Eastern countries not opening the borders? What happened to them? Why you were upset about that? Qatar is building air-conditioned soccer stadium for the 2022 World Cup.
Joe, we've got it. We've talked a lot about the Gulf states, but Hungary, I mean, all these suffering people, and this week that image of the Hungarian photojournalist actually tripping them to the ground, a father or grandfather carrying a little child in Hungary, it's hard to say that it looks good in the face of the suffering. Why not at least let them go on through, Joe?
You know, okay, we will let them go through, but the rule says wherever you land, we have to process them. You're going to let them, the Germans, the Austrians, everybody else is going to send them back. Nobody says that this is the European rule. We are the border town, so we are the border country. If you're going to let them through, then send them back to us.
Joe, we've got it. A Hungarian calling in from Canada there saying, enough with the criticism of Hungary. Rachel, why aren't those trains moving across Europe? Is it Hungary stopping them, or is it Austria? Or today we're hearing about Denmark that says, no trains here, please, from Germany. Is it Germany from afar saying, Hungary, don't you dare let those trains come on up the track?
So I have no idea if there are backdoor secret communications from Germany to Hungary, but having people, you know, whiplashing, you know, Austria saying we'll take in the refugees one day and the next day saying we're going to halt train service, I think it's just reflective of that. There is no plan in place on how to respond to this in a comprehensive way that has services ready to accept and process the refugees, to move along the asylum application. And I think it needs to be pointed out that I feel like this could have been this should not have been the surprise to Europe, to the United States, that it was. You know, the Syrian civil war has been going on
for four years now.
Yes, mm-hmm. Sooner or later, and that these developed, advanced countries are just so flummoxed. You know, it's just disheartening.
Mike in Boston. Mike, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I want the United States to take at least 1 million refugees. We're off by a factor of 100. The reason is simple. Sure, there's 4 million refugees, and the United States has at least a quarter of the blame for the current situation in the Middle East. It's our wars that cause this disruption, and it's our causes, especially those of oil and non-existent WMPs, that have led us to this situation.
Mike, you're breaking up, but I think we got the heart of it. Mike says there are 4 million refugees. The U.S. has at least a quarter of the responsibility for what's unfolded there. So bring 1 million to the USA. Jack, what do you say?
Well, he raises a point about Lebanon. Lebanon has a population of 4 million. It has 1 million refugees. That would be tantamount to almost 75 million in the United States. And we read that the UN has in fact received only about a third of its budget that it has sought for relief for the Syrians in Lebanon this year. So, we're not taking them, and they're not being funded. These people, the NewsHour, PBS NewsHour, did a poignant report on where people are living in Beirut. People living in shanties, living in buildings that are condemned from past bombing that may fall on their families at any moment. Just a desperate situation. Meanwhile, they're reading, these refugees, about what's happening in Germany and what's happening in Europe.
And now Iraqi's joining.
Yes, now that is now becoming another tributary. And so they're almost certainly going to be more and more and more coming across that border. Meanwhile, of course, the Europeans have said, yes, we're going to take the 160,000, but we're also going to process them, and we're going to send back economic migrants. Well, that will be quite a spectacle.
A couple of pieces of sound, at least one here before the break. We've got so much news to get to. Kim Davis, to go from Beirut to Kentucky. Kentucky clerk Kim Davis out of jail after a judge ordered her release when her colleagues back at the clerk's office were issuing same-sex marriage licenses. Here was Kim Davis.
I just want to give God the glory. His people have rallied, and you are a strong people. We serve a living God who knows exactly where each and every one of us is at. Just keep on pressing. Don't let down.
Keep on pressing. Don't let down. She's out of jail. We'll see what happens when she gets back in the office next week. Not back yet, but of course she was greeted there by Mike Huckabee, who helped organize the rally that she walked out into. Ted Cruz showed up. Here's Huckabee saying, here she is. Hoorah.
I believe that her act is going to wake up the politicians, the pastors, and the people. Would you please help me welcome to the stage Kim Davis.
Paul Singer, we've just got half a minute before the break here, but what about the politics of Kim Davis in the current GOP lineup?
This is a shift for Republicans generally from an argument about gay marriage to an argument about religious liberty. And they see Kim Davis as the example of where Christians are being persecuted for their religious views. It's right in the sweet spot for Mike Huckabee.
Huckabee ready to swan dive right into that. Ted Cruz trying to get in there too. Huckabee's people sort of elbowing him to the side. That was some scene in Kentucky. Paul Singer with USA Today. Please stand by in Washington. Rachel Oswald with Roll Call. Jack Beatty. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll talk more about Kim Davis, but in other news this week, Stephen Colbert back on TV. He joked that after playing a character on his Comedy Central Colbert Report, it might take him a while to find himself.
With this show, I begin the search for the real Stephen Colbert. I just hope I don't find him on Ashley Madison.
Okay, the Let's Have an Affair site. Yeah, long live the Queen. Queen Elizabeth became the longest reigning monarch in Britain's history.
Her Majesty, the Queen. Hip, hip.
Inevitably, a long life can pass by many milestones. My own is no exception.
Keep calm and carry on. And after all the controversy, NFL regular season kicked off with Tom Brady and the Patriots front and center.
The Patriot motto this season and tonight certainly might as well be us against the world.
Yeah, and it's just the way they like it around here, isn't it? You know, Tom Brady really wasn't at his best this preseason. Was he distracted? Yeah, probably. Is he motivated tonight? Oh, yeah.
Oh, and off it goes. Oh, boy. We're looking at a week in the news and a Iran deal victory for the president. Sanders catches Clinton in Iowa, the Kentucky clerk out of jail defiant, and the refugees keep coming. You can join us if Bernie Sanders is surging and Biden's maybe not ready to run. Where is the Democrats' race going? Are you fired up for the Jeb Bush tax plan? How about Donald Trump on Carly Fiorina's face? As who wants to look at that, he tells Rolling Stone. What are you thinking on the NFL, Tom Brady, Serena, Colbert, Queen Elizabeth, and on this 14th anniversary of 9/11? With Paul Singer, Washington correspondent for USA Today, Rachel Oswald, foreign policy defense reporter for Roll Call, and our own Jack Beatty. Let's go to Detroit. And Tom, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Okay. What do you see?
Well, you know, in terms of Kim Davis, she's lucky I wasn't in charge, because day one, she would have been had a sign standing out on the corner saying, "Hungry, we'll work for food." Because my point was this: she's an elected official. Okay, she put her left hand on the Bible and raised her right hand to God to support the Constitution of Kentucky and that of the United States. The Supreme Court made same-sex marriage legal, and she should have honored that. Okay, and you know, and her religious beliefs does not supersede what the Supreme Court has made the law of the land.
I believe it's the right hand on the Bible, but we take your point fully, Tom. Paul Singer, where does this go when she walks back in that office, I guess, next week, and her attorney's saying that she and he don't see the marriage licenses, same-sex licenses that have been issued as valid because her signature's not on them. Her subordinates say they're going to, at least some of them, they're going to continue issuing those. But if she stops that or somehow appears to invalidate those, what's the path for her? Is she back in the slammer?
You know, I don't know how Kentucky law works, and I don't know how you get out of this if you have one person who is determined to make themselves the focal point of this argument, right? I mean,
but hasn't the judge said, "Cross me again, and you're going to be back in prison, and it's going to be tougher"?
That is what the judge has said, and again, I don't know how this plays out in a legal standpoint. My question is, if somebody in her position wants to continue to make herself essentially a martyr, I don't know how you stop her from doing that. If she wants to go to jail to make her religious point, she probably can go to jail to make her religious point. I think ultimately, presumably, someone in the state can get involved. It could be a recall. I don't know. I think the issue again,
well, she could be impeached, but it is not absolutely clear looking on from afar that her constituents would impeach her.
Well, and again, this now you're speaking to this issue of she is an elected official. In theory, she is representing a constituency who put her there for this reason. I'm not sure they meant for it to go to this extent, but this is where we get to the issue of community standards. You know, the Supreme Court has struggled with this for years. How do you set a national policy where in some communities it is considered outside the mainstream are offensive. It is the way the Supreme Court has ruled on this. It is the right of these gay couples to be married, treated the same as opposite sex couples. How you enforce that right becomes a challenge. You can't really send the National Guard in to force the Kentucky clerk to issue a marriage license.
I mean, they certainly did it on race with George Wallace. It's been done before when community standards Jim Crow were offended. Hold that thought, Paul, if I may. Let me go to Kevin in Randolph, Massachusetts. Kevin, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
For what it's worth, I don't believe that the people who are supporting Kim Davis really care about Kim Davis or religious freedom, her purported freedom to stand up for her religion. They're just protesting homosexuality. If you go to if you look at the rally sites, you can see the signs they're waving and the things they're screaming. They're citing Leviticus and Deuteronomy, and they're saying words like abomination and sodomites, and they're showing posters of two men kissing with an X across.
What if they believe all that, Kevin? Does it mean anything to you or to her?
It tells me. As far as she's concerned, I don't know what's going on inside her head, but the supporters are coming out and they're pretending that they're in support of Kim Davis, but this is just another opportunity for them to tell America how much they and God hate homosexuality. You barely see a sign at these rallies that say gay marriage or even Kim Davis's name, but they've got the Bible all over it, and they've got, as they say, words like abomination.
Yeah, Kevin, we've got it, and I appreciate your call. Let me get one more. Sam, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. This is I just have a comment about Kim Davis and the Huckabee,
full embrace there.
Mike Huckabee came out in support of Kim Davis. How do you think that's going to affect him or any other Republican presidential candidates that may be speaking out in favor of Kim Davis in their presidential run?
Yeah, let's look at that. Paul, I mean, look right on across the field of Republicans. You've got Mike Huckabee and Ted Cruz actually on the scene, basically trying to hug her up. Huckabee doing more than Cruz. But is this going to become a lockstep thing for Republicans or not?
Well, remember that Huckabee is really playing strongly to a evangelical chorus, particularly in the Iowa caucuses. That's a strong vote in the Iowa caucuses, less so in New Hampshire, perhaps more so in South Carolina. For any of these candidates to be able to stand next to Kim Davis and claim that mantle of religious liberty, I think you will see they're trying to play to a early primary states to see if they can get some victories. I think you will see I'm trying to list all 17 of them in my head as I go through this. I believe you'll see most of them agree that the religious liberty is an important issue. I'm not sure you'll see them all embrace Kim Davis in the same way, in the sense that I think that there is an issue here of Huckabee has suggested basically that we should just sort of annul the Supreme Court's decision and we should overturn the Supreme Court and we don't care what the Supreme Court has to say. I think that's going to be a more extreme approach than others. Like I think Jeb Bush would say, well, it's the law of the land, So that's where you'll find the distinction.
It's pretty difficult to run the USA if you start just ignoring the Supreme Court.
Right.
We'll look more at Republicans, Democrats in the news a lot this week as well. Hillary Clinton telling ABC's David Muir on Tuesday that she was sorry that she had used the private email server, but she said it wasn't her best decision.
I'm sorry that it has, raised all of these questions. I do take responsibility for having made what is clearly not the best decision.
And while she is dealing with that sorry on email, you got Bernie Sanders surging in the polls, talked with CNN on Thursday, explained why he thought his campaign for the presidency was going so well. Neck and neck with Hillary Clinton now in Iowa. Here's Bernie Sanders.
The reason we are doing well is because the issues we are talking about, the need for a political revolution that says that the billionaire class can't have it all, that you need a Congress and a government that represents all of us and not just large campaign contributors. That is what's resonating with the American people.
Jack Beatty, you've got Hillary finally coming to that word sorry. She had resisted it for a long time. Now it's out there. Hedged, but there it is. And at the same time, Bernie Sanders right there with her, 40-41% in the polls in Iowa, and with a lot of wind at his back lately.
Indeed, he has. And part of that wind is sort of a downdraft from Clinton. She's dropped 11 points in 2 months in Iowa. And now 1 in 3 Democrats there say she is not honest or trustworthy. That's not Republicans, that's Democrats. In New Hampshire, she's gone down 20 points. She's lost 20 points to Sanders in 2 months. Now, she's trying to combat that now with a transparency offensive, but my, wouldn't this have been more timely months ago? And she's also going to talk up her experience. But, you know, that's a problem, too. A Bloomberg focus group back in May, but people are still looking at it, of Iowa Democrats found this group of Democrats couldn't think of a single thing she had done. Yes, she's boasted she's traveled 1 million miles, but Carly Fiorina said, well, I've traveled a lot too, only I've got things done. So, you know, you're reading stories that say, use words like panic. You read stories like, you know, the Democrats talking about a plan B if she falters. And the plan B is really to knock Bernie out, that Bernie somehow can't be the Democratic standard bearer because he's a Democratic socialist. Polls show that not even half the voters would entertain the idea of voting for a Democratic socialist. What Sanders is trying to do is to say to folks, look, you're like the character in Molière who was speaking prose without even knowing it. You're really democratic socialist if you start to look at the things you want, and don't let the label bother you.
And meanwhile, Joe Biden still sort of very wobbly on this on Stephen Colbert last night. Who knows where he'll go? There's a little sound of that Biden-Colbert exchange last night, joking about Biden's 2016 plans.
Do you have anything you'd like to tell us right now about your plans?
Yes. I think you should run for president again, and I'll be your vice president.
Yes, says Joe Biden, but he says Stephen Colbert should run for president again. Of course, he had that kind of Colbert-ish funny run last time, and he'd be the VP. But Colbert pressed him on this, came back, and the vice president gave a more serious answer, but it was anything like clear.
I don't think any man or woman should run for president unless they can look at the folks out there and say, I promise you, you have my whole heart, my whole soul, my energy, and my passion to do this. And I'd be lying if I said that I knew I was there.
Paul Singer, does that sound to you like a man who's going to perhaps run for president? It sounds more to me like a guy who's just saying, no, it's not going to happen.
It doesn't sound like any presidential candidate I've ever heard before. I mean, I give Biden credit for his honesty in this matter. I mean, we've got 4 months to the first caucuses, and Biden is saying, basically, I don't know that my heart is all the way there and that I can give 100%. Doesn't sound like a guy who's going to run for president, but who knows? I mean, if the Hillary campaign implodes, maybe he says, well, this is the mantle I have to carry.
Jack, what do the options look like here if Biden is signaling, I don't think so?
Well, the plan B, the photographs are of a gray Al Gore, an equally gray John Kerry. No one is talking about Martin O'Malley, who seems to have just disappeared off the boards. And you know, the Democrats have a serious bench problem. There's not somebody, well, there is somebody, Elizabeth Warren. But she said again and again, she doesn't want to do it. Who knows what would happen if, in fact, Hillary's descent continues, and if it looks like the only alternative is Bernie, and the polls don't show him winning in a national, general election, that might be the moment when the party leans on Elizabeth Warren.
Nick in Burlington, Vermont. Nick, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I'm 23 years old, and I just want to bring this conversation back to Bernie Sanders just for a few minutes, just because we're so isolated and insulated from mainstream politics that he's really making people enthusiastic for the first time in years about wanting to vote and get out and change things, because he's saying things that are completely different than what Hillary's saying and what Joe Biden's saying, despite the fact that they're both honorable choices for president. He's really talking the talk and walking the walk.
He's your senator. Jack Beatty says the label socialist might still get in his way. History would suggest it would. You think we're in a different place here, Nick?
Well, I think that the whole word socialist kind of it has negative connotations that they aren't really fair, considering that we have a history of socialist policies in the last century. And Bernie Sanders is really not saying anything that's radical, even though he's being considered radical. A lot of what he's saying is echoed by most people, especially my age. And it's important that we give him the media time that people can understand his message rather than just having this reflexive reaction every time somebody says the word socialist.
Yeah, I hear you, Nick. He's invited right here. Let's look at the other side of the ledger. Trump this week talking with Rolling Stone, mocking Carly Fiorina, who will be in the next debate just next week, saying, look at that face. Would anyone vote for that? Can you imagine that? The face of our next president telling Rolling Stone, I mean, she's a woman and I'm not supposed to say bad things, but really, folks, come on. Are we serious? Here's Fiorina talking with Fox News, Megyn Kelly.
What do you take that to mean? Look at that face. Would anyone vote for that?
I have no idea. And, you know, honestly, Megan, I'm not going to spend a single cycle wondering what Donald Trump means. But maybe, just maybe, I'm getting under his skin a little bit because I am climbing in the polls.
Yes, she'll be in the debate next week. Jeb Bush has a tax plan out. Paul Singer, what's the heart of that tax plan? Is it still, cut taxes and the country will do better, like Reagan and Bush and Bush and maybe this Bush?
There's some version of that. I mean, you're seeing a bunch of these tax plans come out now. You know, Rand Paul came out with his barely flat tax. I'm not sure tax plans really drive a whole lot of votes. I do want to mention Nick really reflects what we've seen. We've been tracking Facebook data on all these candidates. And what we found is that something like 45% of the people who are talking about Bernie Sanders on Facebook are under the age of 35. For Hillary Clinton, that number is close to like 25 or 30%. So clearly, Bernie Sanders is capturing, in some ways, Donald Trump, also young people and outsiders.
There are a lot of people under 35 in this country if they came out to vote.
Right, right, if they vote.
Jack, where do we go here, Jack? This is more wide open than I can recall.
Nobody could have predicted it in either party that we'd be where we are now. It just shows the total imponderability of the future. Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders, it's happening.
It's going to be some year ahead, and it's really not about the polls. It's about the country's future. Fascinating range of ways out there. Paul Singer with USA Today. Thanks so much for being with us this hour, Paul.
Thanks a lot, Tom. I appreciate the invitation.
Great to have you. And Rachel Oswald at Roll Call. You're terrific, Rachel. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Jack, have a good weekend, sir.
Thank you.
And on this day, we do remember 9/11 and all its victims. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.